2012 marks the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act, and we've been highlighting different species, endangered species, every month here on the program. And for August, we are focusing on Wisconsin's freshwater mussels. And Lisi Kitchell, a conservation biologist with the Bureau of Endangered Resources of our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guest today. She works to protect Wisconsin's native mussels. And she's been on the show before, and happy to have her back. Lisi, thanks for coming by today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's just, for kind of review sake for some people, even for me, because I forgot, how many native species of mussels live here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we have 50 or 51 species, depending on if you're a lumper or a splitter. So we have a good diversity of our native mussels here.
And how many of those are officially endangered or threatened in some way?
We have, 27 of those are listed as threatened, endangered, or special concern. So that's more than half are already listed as being of concern within the state.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is. It's a function of water quality primarily, but also it's a function of a loss of habitat. When the dams were built, they changed the rivers from being flowing waters to pooled areas, and a lot of the mussels really prefer that running water because it brings them their oxygen, brings them their food, gets rid of their waste. So there's a few mussels that occur in lakes and in flowages, but the vast majority of them really want running water. So that's a big piece when the dams were there. And then we also still have water quality issues with sediment and things like that. Certainly our wastewater treatment plants have been cleaned up a lot, and the mussels have recovered from that. But there, you know, there's a lot that's still going in our rivers that still keeps those species limited to where they are.
Lisi Kitchell, our guest today with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, as we talk with her about mussels. And maybe you live near a place where freshwater mussels live. Have you noticed a change in the populations in the last several years? Or if you're a boater, how seriously do you take the recommended precautions for preventing the spread of one mussel we don't like so well, the zebra mussel? Those are things we can talk about today with, among others, with Lisi Kitchell, and I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. We'd love, or a photo, too, if you want, maybe for identifying purposes. We might be able to help you out and help you identify a particular mussel that you may have seen and photographed. Let's talk about the life cycle. What's the life cycle of a freshwater mussel?
Yeah, the life cycle is amazingly complex. People are always surprised at that. There's male and female mussels, and so the males release the sperm. We used to think they just released them generally into the water and hope that they got in the right female. We've since found out that they release them in these things called sperm balls, which have all the heads of the sperm all together and then the tails all on the outside. So it looks like this really cool flagellate thing that goes, and it goes right to the right female of the right species, and then and drops right in her, the incurrent siphon. And then because the females brood the unfertilized eggs along their gills, then as soon as that drops in, it just fertilizes all those eggs along those gills. And then that fertilized egg is called a glochidia, and it develops. And then the females release those in amazing ways. And they look like, for all intents and purposes, like little Pac-Men, two little shells with their just rudimentary internal organs. And the main thing is that these guys are not free living. Once they're released, they actually have to get the blood of fish to actually fully develop. So they don't eat, they don't live independently. All they need to do, they need to get on the gills of a fish so they can get that the blood from the gills. And then that, while they're on the fish, then they develop all their internal organs. And then once they drop off the fish, then they can be a free-living juvenile mussel. So it's amazingly complex. And the other thing is that not all mussels will use all fish. Some mussel species, one species will only use one fish species. Some will use a whole, you know, group of fishes. So it's all over the board in terms of what they use, but they're all specialized in some, to some extent.
Wow. And have we figured out how the sperm, for example, knows to go directly to, is it a scent thing
somehow? The assumption is it's chemical, but we haven't they haven't, at least I'm not aware of the, that they've done definitive studies yet. They just assume it's chemical, because if you put, say, a male at one end of a tank and you put, say, four different females of different species at the other end of the tank, when he releases that, it goes directly to the right female. So it, the assumption is it's chemical, which makes sense. But but I don't know of anybody that's actually done all the work to make that. To know that.
And how are the shells then formed? So the muscle drops off the gills and then drops to the floor of the water.
Right,
or
exactly.
The
substrate, yeah. The shell, they start out with a little tiny shell. Well, it's a little pearly-looking shell that's got the two valves, the two, that's why they're muscles. They have two shells. And they... So that's what they start with, and then that just slowly grows incrementally over time. It grows, they add on to the outer margin of the shell, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And you can age muscles just like you can age tree rings because of those annual growth rings.
And how long will a muscle live?
They're really long-lived. It's surprising. 20, 30, 40 years, 60 years. We've aged them over 100 years.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
60 years.
Yeah, they're... Long lived.
Well, and then and when you were on in early 2011, I think it was, there were two species, the spectacle case, is it? The sheep nose?
Yep, and then we've added the snuffbox, too. So there's now five federally listed species that are occur in Wisconsin, in addition to the other this other species that we have state listed.
What have mussels been used for by our residents here of Wisconsin over the years? What's the history of that?
Well, the Native Americans used them a lot, and they used them for many different things. They used them for tools, for scraping. Some of the mussels are kind of rounded, so they use those for ladles or for, like, hoes. They would attach a wooden stick to them, and we have, you know, archaeological evidence of all that. So they used them for tools. They used them for boats and – or not boats, for platters and things like that. They also used them for decoration, and they used them – for food. There's huge midden piles. It appears that they may have, they're often next to fire pits, so it appears that they smoked them. And whether they cut that up and ate that or ate them just as like a big jerky, we don't really know that. But they, you know, they definitely consumed huge piles of them. If you think about it, it's a lot easier to send the kids out in a stream wading and picking up mussels than to take down a buffalo. So, you know, they could, it was a ready source of food that they could use. And they then they used them for ceremonial purposes, too. And to this day, that a lot of the Native Americans will use mussel shells and burn sage on them. For the Iroquois Nation, they each of the independent tribes or nations had a piece of mussel shell. And when they would come together as a group, then they each would string that on one piece of leather. And when they all those shell pieces were there, then they would tie the knot, and that ceremonially indicated that they were then together as a the whole Iroquois Nation. So they've been used for a lot of purposes for that.
And
historically.
And nowadays?
Okay, so then after the Native Americans and the next big, there were two big eras where mussels were used. One was called the Pearl Rush, and that was back in the early 1800s, where the price of pearl in Europe got so high because the royalty were using it not just as jewelry, but also they were wearing it as headdresses and on their clothing. And so all the local peasants, I guess, were out going out in the streams and ripping open mussels and getting pearls. And native pearls do occur, but they don't occur that commonly. So they were, it was a lot of waste of mussels where they're just ripping them open. But that came over to the United States because people, the price of pearl was so high. So then it became a thing to do, like Sunday afternoons, to pack a picnic lunch and take your horse and buggy and go out to the streamside, send the kids in and gather mussels, and then they'd rip them open. And but the problem was the number of pearls was so low that that went out of fashion here. But we have lots of accounts, you know, from the newspapers in Milwaukee and the likes where that was the Sunday afternoon thing to do. And they say thus and such family went out and did, you know, this kind of thing. So that went by the wayside, and that was good because it was a lot of mussels got killed in the meantime from that. And like in Europe, there are streams that have never recovered because they just literally took everything that was there. But then the next big stage was the pearl button industry. And George Beppel came over from Germany. He was a button maker over there. And in those days, they'd made buttons out of wood and antlers and, you know, bone and all kinds of things, nutshells and things like that. And he was out fishing and he stepped on what's called a heel splitter. It's called that because it has a very sharp edge. And he said, ow, and then he picked it up and looked at it, and it was really pretty and pearly inside, and he said, this would make beautiful buttons. So he devised a system to make buttons, which was, it's basically just a die that cuts that circle out of the shells, and then it became really, button factories blossomed everywhere, because it was a very simple system. It looked like an old treadle sewing machine that ran the die, and it cut the buttons, and then you bagged those up and you sent them to the button factory, and then they polished the shells and put in the holes for the sewing the buttons on. So that was like in 1880, and then he went on for a long, long time, until the 1940s. And then two things
happened. That's a long time.
Yeah, it was. Two things happened in the 40s. One, World War II, the men went off to war, nobody was collecting shells. At the same time, during World War II, then plastic was developed. So plastic took over, and that whole industry kind of died out.
Probably good for the mussels.
It was, exactly. they were starting to get to the point where they were being over-harvested. They were so abundant that was not a problem, but towards the end, that they were starting to get over-harvested. So that gave them a relief, and the mussels recovered. And then the next phase that happened was when, after World War II, or as a result of World War II, Japan was looking at ways to improve their economy. And they, in Japan, had been carving little Buddhas and inserting them in oyster shells for literally thousands of years. And so they would get these, you know, shiny little Buddhas out, and somebody came up with the idea of cultured pearls, so you would actually control the quality, the size, you know, of pearls, and also quicken the pace with which you could get pearls. So they went around the world looking for the best nuclei or the best circle, a center for these cultured pearls. And lo and behold, the Upper Mississippi River was one of the best in the world. And it's a function of our soil. We have lots of calcium carbonate in our soil. So it makes really good shell material. So the quality of the shell was really good. So they started going along the Mississippi River saying, we want to buy clam shells from you. And because of the pearl button industry, either the sons or the grandsons of the guys that had been pearl button guys still had the boat in the back 40.
And knew how to do it,
exactly,
probably.
Exactly, yeah. So they were really fortunate that there had already been this this system that was already in place. And so the guys pulled their boats back out and started dragging for mussels again. So
Interesting stuff. Lacey Kitchell, our guest today, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about one of our endangered species, mussels, many species, many types of them here in the state of Wisconsin. Interesting story about our mussels. I'm glad to have you listening in. If you have questions for her, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. Marika Subal, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lacey Kitchell, our guest today, mussel expert and conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Again, if you have a question about mussels or a story to share, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show or email us at talk@WPR.org. And we have lots of callers online. Maybe we should take a phone call or two. And let's see if we can get Jill on. Jill in Arborvita. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. I have an interesting question for your guest. We live on a lake in Vilas County, and we have, I don't know if it's mussels or clams, but they're 4 to 6 inches, kind of an oval, more of an oval shape than a round shape, and they have a big hunk of meat in them. The animals come down to the lake, and raccoons eat them, and was wondering if that's a mussel or a clam.
Yeah. Mussels and clams, I get asked that question all the time, and technically, scientifically, there's differences, but for vernacular purposes, people use them interchangeably. Yeah, exactly. Same thing. And the DNR clam regs are actually written as clam regs. They're not even written as mussel regs. So you can call them whatever you want to call them.
Okay.
And yeah, a lot of things eat them. And that that hard thing is the foot. That's what they crawl around with. Just envision like a snail with its shell. These guys have the same thing. So they crawl around with that foot, and that's what, well, they eat the guts too. But that's what a lot of the raccoons, mink, otter, all those guys, muskrats eat them. And you, I can't tell you what you might have. You probably have spikes, but you might have black sand shells. And there's also pocketbooks and fat muckets that would occur up by you. So there's lots of different mussels up there.
So if I were to go on the DNR website, do you have pictures or information?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Lisa. There's great information there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a posting on the website that has lots of information on it about the different species and the citizen monitoring network, and it just some videos, too, that show you how the clams get on the fish and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I highly recommend it.
And there's a booklet. And I don't know if this would help her out or not. Yeah, it's called Freshwater Mussels of the Upper Mississippi River.
Okay.
And tell us about it. This is a great little book because it'll fit in your pocket and nice colored photos.
Yeah.
And a little story about each mussel.
Right. And you can try to match the pictures with what you've got in hand. What's nice about mussels is they leave shells behind. You don't have to kill them to be able to identify them. You can pick up the shells and figure that out. And, you know, they're not hard to chase. So, the booklet's available, and you could contact me, and I can send it to you. It has all of the mussels that are here in Wisconsin, except for one that only occurs in the Lake Michigan drainage. It's a great booklet. And
is it free, or is it?
It's free, and there's actually a copy of it posted if you want to print it off. We've got a PDF version of it on the website. So
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Very interesting, and I'll continue to listen.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And you're on that website, too, so
yes.
If people want to get a hold of you, they
yep.
can just go right there. And we have a link to an article, at least an article about the drought.
Yeah. That was
and affecting. So the droughts had some probably a negative effect on mussels and
clams. I have been pleasantly surprised at how many people have actually called me about the drought and how many concerned citizens there were that said, you know, these mussels are getting stranded. What should we do? And it's just as the waters have lowered because of the low water conditions and the shorelines have been kind of exposed, then there's mussels that get exposed. A lot of times they'll go for deeper water, but sometimes they're blocked by logs or rocks or something. Or they go the wrong direction. And I just tell people, pick them up, throw them in deeper water. But I've been really amazed at how many people do call.
That's great.
Yeah, it says people are out there watching and they really care.
Let's turn to Cynthia in Nina next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello. I have had the opportunity to go to Fremont, Wisconsin. And in the hotel there, they have newspaper articles from long, long time ago hanging on the wall regarding the Wolf River Button Company.
Yep.
Do you know anything about that?
Well, I don't know a lot of details about that, but boy, we had button companies on the Wisconsin, on the Wolf, up and down the whole Mississippi, on the Sugar, on the Milwaukee River. In fact, when they took out the North Avenue Dam at Milwaukee, I got a call, and they're like, there's mussel shells everywhere. And I thought, what? And then they said, and they've got holes in them. And I said, oh. And I realized, it turns out there was a button dam right next to, or a button factory right next to where they put the dam. So they used the shell materials, fill material in the dam. So when they removed the dam, that all started washing out. But there were button factories. They sprung up all over because it was very easy to build them, and the machines were simple. They didn't require much, and the clammers would just bring the shells to those button factories. And a lot of times you'll see pictures where they have piles of the shells with the holes cut in them.
That's great.
Do you may I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead.
Do you know how the buttons are dyed?
They weren't dyed. The actual, plastic buttons are dyed, but the native mussels were not dyed. They actually have the inside of the shell, which is called the nacre, but it's that mother of pearl in the inside, and that varies in color from lavender to purple to pink to orange to, I've seen green, I've seen blue. I've seen a dark enough lavender that was almost black. So when they made colored buttons, it was because the inside of the shell was that color.
Very interesting. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Bruce in Rhinelander, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I'd like to ask the lady a question. She's obviously quite knowledgeable. I'm an aquatic biologist myself, and I'm 85 years old. The question I have is, how far upstream have you found zebra mussels? What's the smallest stream that you would find zebra mussels in your experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. My experience has been I found them in the bigger rivers, but we've also found them in as small as something like the Bark River in the southeast part of the state. What happens is if you've got smaller rivers that have impoundments on them, and then if the zebra mussels get introduced from, say, you know, recreational boaters in those impoundments, then it's a constant source population downstream for those streams. So they can occur in a fairly, you know, small stream if there's that source population from an impoundment at the upper reaches of those streams.
Yeah, my familiarity with them has always been on the larger rivers like the Mississippi and the Illinois.
Right.
I got a comment to make you might be interested in. I met one of the Japanese people in the 1950s that was over here investigating our mussels to see whether they were appropriate for insertion into the oysters in Japan. He was working for Mikimoto.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, I've got a book about it. And if you want to read the book, you might find a chapter about that early mussel industry that the Japanese got into.
Yeah. Hmm. Oh, yeah, I would be interested.
What's the title of your book?
It's called Spam Cans, Rice Balls, and Pearls.
Okay. Spam Cans, Rice Balls, and Pearls.
That's correct.
Yeah. Oh, well, that sounds great. If I could get your contact information, I'd like to. Well, I can just remember the name of the book. That's a unique enough title that I could.
Okay, well, look on Amazon.com and look up my name. You'll find it.
Okay. All right.
Bruce, what's your last name, Bruce?
Spelled M-U-E-N-C-H.
All right. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Well, that sounds like a fun read, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does, actually. It really does.
Appreciate that call. And Steve in Lake Geneva, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, hi there. Considering the mussels' longer lifespan, what can climate scientists learn from biologists who are studying these species? And what adaptive changes resulting from human-induced changes over the last few decades or 100 years to the mussels' natural habitats are biologists seeing on the ground?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any specific studies, but what I have are personal observations and discussion with other folks that do mussels. This summer would be a good example. The streams with the low water and the high temps, those streams were cooking, and these guys were obviously stressed. Some of them were releasing young before they were necessarily there were fish around, you know, at the right time because they were just trying to breathe in the water because of the high temps. And so, you know, there's the potential for these guys not, aborting the young before they're ready to go. Another piece is that when you think mussels, you got to think fish. And so when you think fish, and if you're looking at things changing, water temperatures changing, fish moving around, that could significantly alter where these mussels occur because they drop off the fish. So if the fish are moving, and then you know you might be altering where these guys occur.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And finally, I have some open lines. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Dave in Heartland, it's your turn. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. When I was a youngster in the early 50s, I grew up in Buffalo, Iowa, which is just downstream from Davenport. And in the back of the yard was a button factory. And it was still operating. And this would have been, like I said, early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also downstream from a couple of huge quarries for cement. And I was just wondering if that created a favorable environment for the mussels.
Yeah, it easily could. And the, a lot of the streams had a lot of stuff that made it, you know, really good for mussels. And in those days, the mussels were so abundant, and they still can be abundant, but like with the commercial guys that were dragging for mussels, that the way they drag for them, it's only 1% efficient in terms of what, you know, sampling the bottom. However, they could get a ton a day. So they, the mussels were just that abundant in the rivers.
Boy.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks. I was always fascinated by the huge piles of shells with holes in them until someone explained to me what that was for. Because I never saw the buttons. I just saw the shells.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Was it just one hole per shell?
Oh, no, no. Yeah. They would get as many as they could crank out of them. You'll see some shells, depending on the shape of the shell and the size of the shell, you'll see 10, 12 blanks. And the size of the button. That's the other piece, too.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Rita emailed and she wondered about, are the mussels clams? And we talked about that earlier. They are clams. She says, on my husband's land is a pond, and there are half shells. Are these clams or mussels?
Yeah, they probably are. And they might be floaters, which is a really common pond species. And what happens is when the animals eat them, they just rip them open, then that's where the shells, the two valves get separated from each other. And so that's why they're laying around. And that's not uncommon at all.
And a Facebook message from Jerry, who's from Princeton, Wisconsin, a well-known place where shells were collected from the Fox River and were punched for buttons. There are still remnants of huge piles of shells with multiple holes punched in them.
Oh, that's great.
Princeton area.
Yeah.
And then from Jeff, a Facebook message, my wife, Anna, is currently on the Chippewa River finding black sand shells, white and pink heel splitter, and pocketbook freshwater mussels. She was awarded a grant from the DNR through Beaver Creek Reserve to catalog the native freshwater mussels in Eau Claire.
Oh, that's excellent. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Those are those grants went out to citizen monitoring groups what we're trying to do is there's no way we can get out there and cover the state in terms of what is our existing mussel populations. We have records all the way back from the 1800s of the state of where mussels occurred. So it's wonderful that the citizen monitors are out there looking. It's a very easy thing to do. If you're in a wadeable water, the shell's there. You can pick it up. You can bag it. So it's a very easy and practical thing to be able to do, and it's wonderful that they're out there documenting what's out there.
That's very cool. Chris and Madison, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you very much. I hope you can answer a question I've had on my mind for about 50 years. I grew up in Milwaukee, and a friend and myself, when we were about 10 years old, were digging around where they were building the I-90 system. So this would have been in the late 50s, early 60s. And it was around the area that's about one exit west of where you'd get off for the baseball stadium. And we found a whole bunch of what I am assuming are mussel shells. They were about the size of your palm and very bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if that area was an ancient seabed or how did they get there?
No, it was probably, I mean, were you in the river at the time or were you on dry land?
No, dry land.
Yep,
Yeah.
So that was probably a midden pile from the Native Americans. I mean, they harvested tons of mussels. And the bumps on them, there's the mussels were named by the commercial clammers way back in the 1880s. So those were probably pimplebacks with the bumps on them. And and they probably were part of, if you were an archaeologist and had dug deeper and around, you'd have found a fire pit somewhere nearby, and then that would have been, they would have just hauled a whole bunch of there and harvested them and then used them for food.
So was there a river, an ancient riverbed in that area? I mean, because usually you'd expect Native Americans would be living near a water source.
I'm not familiar with that, but there could have been. I mean, it makes sense if there were shells right there. We just had a restoration project that's going down at the Rainbow Springs Resort, which used to be a resort and is now owned by the DNR, and they were trying to look. They had done a bunch of filling in what was the original river there, and they were trying to figure out when they hit where the original riverbed was. And sure enough, when they hit a whole section that had all the clamshells in there, then they were like, ah, We know where we are because these guys would have been in the bottom of the river. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I think that that sparked an early recreational interest in archaeology for me because I just thought it was amazing that we found these things. So.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Right. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
you
thanks, Chris. Mary from Duluth emailed in wondering if any of the rivers flowing into Lake Superior or Lake Michigan have mussels or are mussels found primarily in the Mississippi River drainage.
Yeah, the greatest diversity is found in the Mississippi River drainage. However, you can get really high numbers in both Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. Ironically, you kind of have to look at those drainages, but their species in those waters are more closely affiliated with the Atlantic slope species than they are with the Mississippi River. But you've got, especially up in Lake Superior, you've got like the Eastern Elliptio, which is really common on the East Coast, but that's one of the few places in the Great Lakes that it occurs, Shequamagon Bay. There's mussels there, and they can be pretty dense. So there's probably a dozen species or more that occur in the actual Lake Michigan and
Very
Lake
cool.
Superior Basin.
Very cool. Paul and Nina, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Today I wanted to ask you, if I could, about zebra mussels. Seems to be that's a popular topic in our area. And it seems to be changing the ecology of Lake Winnebago. Lake Winnebago seems to have a lot more algae and growth from the bottom that's blocking the shoreline. And the story goes around here that it's related to the zebra mussels cleaning the water so it's so clear that the sunshine goes down to the bottom and promotes this growth. Tell me about that. Is that true, or what do you think?
Yep, you nailed it. That's what happens. The zebra mussels come in. Our native mussels are good filters, too. In fact, that's a good benefit that they offer to systems. But the zebra mussels come in, and they filter too much. They take everything. I mean, they take everything to the point that they kill themselves, which just doesn't seem like a good strategy, but it works for them. So they take everything out of the water, which increases the water clarity, so your aquatic vegetation grows up. You get these big, long cladophora and algal mats that occur. And the big thing in Winnebago, too, is that then they're short-lived. They only live two, at the most, 3 years, and then they die. And then you have these shells and literally the tonnage of shell that's left in the lake. And it's been causing problems, windrows of shells, not only on the beaches, so you can't walk on the beaches barefoot anymore, but also it's blocking channels for boaters. There was one fellow that estimated it would take 4 pickup trucks full to clear the channel for his boat to get into his pier. So the shells and what they leave behind is quite a nuisance, too.
Terrible.
Is there any way we can get rid of them?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
I would love to find something to get rid of them. They are working on different techniques. What the different companies have done, the power plants and the water intake valves, what they do is they drip chlorine or some other agent at the intake valve, so they kill them as they come in. But we've not found good things that can kill just the zebra mussels and not the other stuff. They're investigating one. It's called a bio bullet right now, but it's under process of being investigated. So if they figure out a way to do it, that'd be great.
Boy, would it ever.
Very good. Well, we're not too thrilled with them up here.
Yeah,
no.
I couldn't agree with you more.
That's
all the more reason to really be careful about transporting them to new bodies of water, because they certainly didn't start out in Lake Winnebago.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Let's see. We have Angeline sent a Facebook question, or is it a... who says, we have an acre and a half pond lived with for the past 25 years. We knew it had pond mussels because once in a while we would see shells left by raccoons. Normally our pond flushes every spring, and with the thawing of snow or exceptionally heavy rains, the past couple years it hasn't because of lower rain and so forth. Despite this, for the past 2 years, more shells than any other time we've lived here are littering the banks of the pond. Are the raccoons just getting better, or what do you think?
I think it's, if you're having low water conditions, they're looking for more food sources. So they're probably able to reach mussels that were in deeper water that they maybe couldn't get as easily, but now they're in shallower water and much more easily gotten. And then also because maybe some of their other food sources aren't as available, so they're going to be eating more mussels.
And Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I was wondering, what do the mussels and the clams eat in the ocean compared to the rivers that makes them so much more palatable? The ones from the ocean are so good, but from what I understand, the ones in the rivers, besides from being probably extremely toxic, right, aren't very good to eat.
Yeah, good question. So the saltwater mussels are the ones we traditionally eat. I don't know if it's what they eat that makes them taste better or the fact that they're soaked in salt water. I don't know. Our native freshwater mussels, I've not eaten them. The Native Americans ate them. I don't encourage people to eat them because they're really good concentrators of any contaminants in the water.
Yeah.
So that's why I don't encourage people to do that. However, that said, some of the old river rats on the Mississippi River, they eat everything out of the river, and so their body burden is exceeds anything anyway. And these guys, I've talked with them, and what they do is they put the mussels through a meat grinder, so you get that kind of extrudent kind of stuff, and then they make fritters or chowder out of them. But the actual foot is quite tough on our Native American mussels that are the freshwater mussels. So I don't think it's what they eat. You ask what they eat. Our native mussels eat primarily green algae and diatoms. So they take everything in, and then they select that stuff out, and then they spit out the rest, which then makes it available to other species on the bottom.
Hmm. And Steve in Fremont, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a question in regards to the Wolf River Basin area.
Okay.
I have grown up there my whole life, and in fact, when we used to go fishing on the Wolf River for white bass and walleye and such, we always had a heck of a problem catching clams and mussels. They would actually seize onto the sinkers, and then you thought you had a fish, but they actually had a clam.
Yeah.
And in New London, they actually had a button factory, but they're all gone now. It's very seldom that you even see a clam. I was wondering what could have happened to the ecosystem that they disappeared out of them and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that what happened is a lot of things were, in terms of the Wolf River, there were some factories that were discharging that just reduced the water quality. There's a huge sediment load. And they the other thing is you have to link mussels with fish. So if it wasn't suitable for the fish and the fish hosts, you know, went away, then the mussels, you know, died out. So, and a lot of people report snagging them with fish hooks or with sinkers. That's, you know, not uncommon at all, actually.
Yeah, we used to get them all the time on fish hooks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I realize that, but on that section of the Wolf, there virtually is no factories or anything.
Right.
No.
Yeah, I think that that's a hard question there. We've been doing recent surveys on the Wolf, and we have found more mussels than we expected to see there. So I think that they might be there. They're just not as common as they once were.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lisi, thank you so much. Boy, was this fun.
Oh, you bet. Anytime.
I learned a lot, and I think everybody else did, too. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Once again, the website, where do we go for?
You can go just to the DNR website and look up, just you can keyword mussels in there. For the citizen monitoring, it's under WI@tree. /inventory/mussels. But I think if you go to the DNR website, and just put in mussels, you'll get. And if you put in freshwater mussels, you'll eliminate a lot of the zebra mussel stuff.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, you bet.
And we'll have her back. We definitely will. Lisi Kitchell, conservation biologist with the Bureau of Endangered Resources, with our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She works to protect our native mussels, and we'll have her back, and we'll do this again. These monthly segments of the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act, I think, have just been great. Great to have Lisi come by and all the other guests we've had. Coming up next, though, we'll talk with Jim Bracken. He has a new novel out. It takes place in 1880s Wisconsin, in a lumber camp, primarily. And it was an interesting read for me, and I think you're probably going to enjoy hearing what he's got to say about lumbering and back in the 1800s and about his novel. Coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.